Look with me at chapter 5, verse 4. As Paul thinks about the sufferings and the trials, he understands them as shaping us. The suffering produces endurance, which produces character. And then as that final goal, it produces hope, making us people whose every decision ought to be motivated by a longing to spend eternity with God. The sufferings transform us into a people of hope. Hope is a great theme of the Old Testament. You could say perhaps the great theme. The authors understood that the world was not as it should be. God had broken into their minds and made them discontent with the fallenness of the world. To those cultures around the Israelites, and to most pagan cultures that have existed, the gods tend to be thought of like glorified men and women with the same weaknesses as us. And so evils like fighting and bloodshed and war are not thought to be expressions of the fallenness of the world, but can be glorified in or celebrated. And these people tend to be content with the world as it is, with no hope for it to be transformed. And so time in these cultures tends to be circular. What has happened before will happen again, and this will go on for eternity. And to most people, that's simply how the world is. But to the Israelites, God had revealed an entirely different conception of history. And to them, he was the God of hope. To see how fundamental this is to the Old Testament story, turn with me to the first page of your Bible, to Genesis chapter 1. So here in the beginning, we see a universe in chaos and disorder. In Genesis 1 verse 2, all is described as formless and void. And you could translate that as just wild and waste. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was wild and waste. And then verse 2, darkness is over the deep. And remember that the Jews were not a sea-loving people at the best of times. The sea was a dangerous force where you might be attacked or drowned. And the word deep here is their most sinister word for the sea. It's bad enough for the Jews that the sea existed out there while they were safely on dry land. But in the beginning, all is described as sea, and with that word deep, and all is dark. But when God comes into view, everything looks different. In verse 2 again, darkness is over the deep. But paralleled with that, the Spirit of God hovers over the waters. So the waters and the deep there refer to the same thing. They refer to the sea. But deep is packed with these negative connotations, whereas waters is a fairly neutral term. And so already, just by God's presence being noted, some of the darkness seems to have lifted. And then with God, everything is made right. In verse 3, he creates light in the darkness. In verse 6, even the waters, that chaotic and dangerous sea, obey his voice. Verse 9, he speaks and land appears. And so God is bringing this wilderness and waste into order. And then on the seventh day, when all is complete and all is very good, something changes in the way that the days are described. Remember that these scriptures are written so carefully that no detail is accidental. In chapter 1 verse 5, there was evening and morning the first day. Chapter 1 verse 8, there's evening and morning the second day. Chapter 1 verse 13, there's evening and morning the third day. And the same on day 4, day 5, and day 6. And so on, until the last day, day 7, the Sabbath day. And you'll notice that there is no evening and no morning there. And so it seems to me like there's just a hint that the time that governed days 1 to 6 doesn't function the same way here. It's almost like we kind of pass beyond time, pass into eternity, and it's not come to an end like the rest of them. Creation is to exist in a permanent state of God-given rest, where God has taken up his seat permanently as ruler and king over creation. It's the climax of the passage. Goodness has been perfectly achieved, chaos and order perfectly subdued, and what was wilderness and waste before is a beautiful garden. And that's the story of the whole Bible, isn't it? Like, God reigns and is sovereign over all, and he's bringing all evil and all chaos to an end. And then there will be eternal Sabbath rest, no evening and no morning. But the Old Testament isn't written from the state of the completeness and perfection and the order of the seventh day. Rather, it's written in the midst of the chaos, in the midst of the evil, in which God is sometimes working quietly, sometimes dramatically, but working all things into that perfect future state of rest and harmony. And the point of going back to Genesis 1 is to say that right from the beginning of the Old Testament and the Jewish scriptures, the hope was there, the hope of a God who casts light over darkness. I think it's quite easy for us, as people who enjoy so many of the comforts of the modern world, like houses and jobs and families and clothes, that we can be content with what we have, that we don't have the eager expectation for the new age that Paul had. We don't realise that we need rescuing from our darkness, because we don't realise we are in darkness most of the time. For the Israelites, having been slaves under the Egyptians and then sent into exile under the Babylonians, having been subjugated by the Greeks and the Persians conquered by the Roman Empire, the earthly hopes of being a prosperous nation had always come to nothing. And so they needed a hope that's not of this world. And this isn't just for the Jews. Ultimately, it's for all of us, because, as C.S. Lewis writes, summarizing what science says about the nature of the universe itself, nature never restores order where disorder has occurred. These laws between them, irreversible death and irreversible entropy, are what St. Paul calls the futility of nature, her ruinousness. And the film is never reversed. From the moment, so the movement from order to less almost serves to determine the direction in which time is flowing. And so, you could almost define the future as the period in which what is now living will be dead. And so because of that, because that's the nature of the universe, we need a hope which is outside the universe, something outside the cycle of disappointments, a hope in God who shines light into the darkness of our world. And it's this emphasis on hope that Paul inherits. In the face of exile and darkness, to say that God is still going to act to make right all that is wrong. And so the sufferings make us realize that our earthly hopes will always disappoint. Our sufferings therefore mold us into people who can do nothing, or should be able to do nothing, but hope in God. And so once we've seen that the purpose, or one of the purposes of our sufferings, is to shape us into a people of hope, now let's look at the greatness of our hope in comparison to our sufferings. So if you come back with me to Romans 8, verse 18. Paul writes that the sufferings we experience now are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is coming, the glory that we hope for, that will be revealed in us. And it's a little bit like a schoolboy on his last day of school before the summer holidays. The day seems endless, the work is really hard and really boring, and his uniform is very uncomfortable, and the bell feels like it's never going to come. And yet, eventually it will. And all the boredom and all the discomfort can be completely forgotten, and there'll be the prospect of enjoying a seemingly endless summer, and the hard work and the uncomfortable uniform will pale completely into insignificance at the arrival of the holidays. The knowledge that our present sufferings are just a tiny shadow compared with the immense joy that is to come should bring us so much comfort. In verse 22, Paul uses the image of childbirth to describe this, and it's surely one of the best displays of sufferings being turned to joy. Though it involves agony, there are few things more joyous than a baby being born. And in the face of the happiness of becoming a mother, the pain seems almost inconsequential. In themselves, our earthly pains feel so large, and in our thinking, I don't think we should try and pretend like they're not. They're not okay, they're not awful. It's only when compared with the good that God will bring that our suffering should begin to look small and insignificant. a mere shadow now compared with the solid good that is coming. So our sufferings transform us into people of hope. Our sufferings are insignificant compared with the joy that they bring. Thirdly, it's not only human beings who are hoping. If you look down at Romans 8, verse 19, you might notice something rather surprising. Paul writes that creation waits with eager longing for the glory which is to be revealed in us. And I think this is one of the verses that we as modern people find quite difficult to appreciate. The view which Paul has clearly of a nature which is both groaning under sin and hoping in God. The Scottish writer George MacDonald describes seeing this hope a little bit like this. See every flower straighten its stalk, lift up its neck with an outstretched head, and stand expectant. Something more than the sun, greater than the light, is coming, and the necks of all creation are stretched out to see him come. Every morning will they thus outstretch themselves, and every evening will they droop and wait until he comes. And so you have that picture there of the flower doing what it does every day, rising and then drooping at night, but seeing it every morning as lifting its neck towards that, towards the sun, but also towards that which is greater than the sun, and every evening drooping and waiting for his coming. We tend to think of creation a bit like a machine, like a mechanism that runs like clockwork according to very fixed rules. And nature, in our view, can't have longings, and it can't have hopes, and we can't say that creation is groaning. But this mechanical view of nature is quite peculiar to our modern age, and the older way of talking about it is quite different. Dante, for example, talks about the stars revolving because of love, and Psalm 19 describes the sun as running its course with joy. And these metaphors of a living nature seem to be a far more natural way to talk about creation. And it doesn't come easy to us, because we've lost our understanding of the true nature of creation. It's not that we're just more intelligent than, say, Dante or the psalmist or anyone that thought of nature as alive. Rather, we're just blind to it. And so with Paul, let's try and reaccustom our eyes to see creation as it truly is, groaning under the weight of sin, groaning under the curse, and groaning in its absence from God, and longing for him to come and the sons of God to be revealed. And then longing for the sons of God here, it seems quite surprising, because we could, well, I think it would be natural to expect God's coming to be a sufficient thing to hope in, but Paul seems to set the hope of creation in the revealing of God's children, in the revealing of the glory of the church, of us. And I think to understand this, we have to come back to man's vocation as image bearers of God. If we go back to Genesis 1, where creation is perfectly obedient to God, where God speaks and creatures come into existence, he speaks and the land and the seas separate, he speaks and man comes into being, and the voice of God rules perfectly over nature, and nature perfectly submits to God, her king. And this is like the first thing that we learn about God when we open our Old Testament. And in this same passage, we're told that man is made in the image of this God, that we're made in the image of creation's king. And so it's no surprise that as soon as we're told that man is made in the image of God, that he is told in verse 28 of chapter 1 of Genesis, to fill the earth and subdue it, and to have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. We might have a tendency to become slightly uncomfortable with the idea of dominion or kingship over creation. And perhaps rightly so, man's being superior over creation has often resulted in travesties and like oil spills and the like. And we've tended to use our superiority to abuse and exploit creation and the animals rather than to steward them. But Jesus shows us that a king is crowned to serve. And so rather than exploit creation, man's responsibility was to protect creation from exploitation. Man's role was to lead creation to thrive in the way that God had intended, just like an earthly king is not to make use of his subjects for slaves. And so MacDonald again, imagining a redeemed creation with redeemed animals and a redeemed relationship between man and beast, writes that the animals will glory to serve redeemed humanity, will joy to come to them for help. The heart that cries Abba, Father, cries to the God of the sparrow and the oxen. Nor can hope go too far in hoping for what God will do for creation. Nature longs for the revealing of the sons and daughters of God because it wants the restoration of its rightful rulers, like a nation which has been oppressed by a tyrannical king, longing for the evil government to be overthrown and the righteous government to be reinstated. And so we saw firstly how our sufferings produce hope. Secondly, the greatness of our hope relative to our sufferings. Thirdly, that it's all of creation that is hoping for this. And fourthly and finally, that our hope is for perfect freedom. In Romans 8, verse 20, Paul explains that the reason for nature's longing was because it was subjected to futility, and it's become bound and enslaved by its brokenness. And in all of this, there was still hope. That is from the end of chapter 8, verse 20. Hope that creation would once again be brought to function as it ought, that creation would be released from this subjection to brokenness, and that someone from outside the circle of the fallen universe would step in and restore it to its proper order. And that is what we mean when we say freedom. In the modern West, it's easy to think of freedom as just having unlimited choices. But that's not the sense in which we mean it. We don't mean that nature's going to have a will to do whatever it likes, but rather that to be fully free in the Christian and just ancient sense of freedom is to attain that to which it's originally designed, to have for what it ceaselessly yearns for. And anything that separates it from that end is a form of bondage. And so the freedom of the glory of the children of God is what we and the universe are made for, the fulfillment of the deepest desires of our soul and the greatest hope and desire that we have, to be freed from the power of sin over us and to dwell with God as his perfected and beloved children, taking up our role as leaders in creation. And that's what Paul means by freedom. And so, as we come to a close, let's just finish with a few verses from Isaiah 40, which I think really nicely capture this hope. Go on up a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up, fear not. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the Lord comes with might, and his arm rules for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his recompense before him. He will tend his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms, and he will carry them in his bosom, and gently lead those that are with young. We have a very deep longing within us, shaped by our sufferings, for a redeemed world and a world where sin and death have no more power over us. And that's our hope.